Hello, and thank you for joining us for the 2020 Annual Business Law Institute. It is important for us to uphold a Polsinelli tradition of providing an innovative CLE program to our clients, general counsel friends, and Polsinelli alumni. And given the circumstances, we are pleased to be able to do so in a virtual setting. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer two CLE polling questions. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling questions. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the program to all those who answered the polling questions. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speaker throughout the webinar. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Polsinelli's General Counsel, Doug Laird.
Thank you, Ashley. Good morning and good afternoon to everybody out there. Thank you for attending. Today, we're going to be doing an ethics presentation, and it is a little bit different than the usual somewhat dry discussion that is usually how we characterize an ethics discussion. So it's a little fun when we can delve into some current affairs type issues, and we are able to do that to a certain extent today. Let me talk a little bit about what we're going to be discussing today, and I want to do a little bit of an introduction, and then we'll start going through the slides. Our focus today is Model Rule 8.4G, which was adopted by the ABA back in 2016, and has become particularly relevant as a result of a number of events over the last 6 months or so. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery are all names that are familiar to all of us now. They created, or the events surrounding them have created special attention for issues with regard to race and gender. And the ABA back in 2016 took some steps to require lawyers to have more attention to some of these issues. Now, I want to admit as we get started that these are difficult, sometimes considered to be political, and certainly loaded topics that I'm going to be talking about today. It is not my purpose to try to follow any particular agenda, but to discuss the attributes of Rule 8.4G and the different states that have adopted similar rules and try to discuss the issues brought forth by those rules, and they include explicit and implicit bias, diversity and inclusion, cultural competency are all things that have become a part of the obligation of some lawyers, most lawyers across the country, but not all, that we need to be aware of and need to deal with. I'm going to stress in the first third of the presentation the ABA rules and the different ethical rules or model rules of professional conduct that are around the country, and try to give a general sort of view about that, because we can't talk about one jurisdiction because we have listeners that are in lots of different places. The middle part of the presentation will deal with some fairly specific examples of explicit and possibly implicit bias, and talk about some studies that have been conducted to try to demonstrate the risks of implicit bias, and so you can be aware of those things and hopefully guide your own behavior to avoid explicit bias, certainly, and then also avoid implicit bias when it may occur without your clear knowledge of it. And at the end, we're going to talk about a new ABA ethics opinion that addresses the whole new rule of 8.4G and how it should be applied in the real world, and give some specific examples to try to help everyone understand what the rules provide and what they don't provide. I know there's been a lot of interest in the whole idea of the new CLE requirement that is adopted in many states. I'll give the example here of Missouri rule that says that at least one of the three basic ethics credit hours must be devoted exclusively to explicit or implicit bias, diversity, inclusion, or cultural competency. And for Missouri, this was adopted fairly recently. In Missouri, this is the first year of having this. There are a number of other states that have adopted those, this special CLE rule. Those states are listed in the screen that you have in front of you. The ones underlined are jurisdictions where Pozzanelli has offices. But I want to emphasize that the program we're doing today is designed specifically to meet this requirement. But for those states where you do not have this special and new CLE requirement concerning diversity and inclusion and harassment, this will still count as a regular ethics CLE for you, and you don't need to be concerned about losing your credit here. This hour is designed to satisfy the general rule for ethics requirements and also the specific one that is applied to harassment and diversity and inclusion. I mentioned earlier that there is a new ABA rule. I'm going to spend some time talking about it, but there, you might argue with me that it's not worth that time because although it is was adopted by the ABA back in 2016 and is part of a vanguard of the rules talking about these issues, it has only been adopted by one state. The rules, as you understand, I'm sure you know, that the ABA adopts the model rules of professional conduct, and they don't necessarily apply to any lawyer unless a particular jurisdiction, usually a state Supreme Court, expressly adopts that rule. And so we only have so far one state that has adopted this, but nevertheless, it's important for us to understand the rules that are in place in other states that are similar to 8.4G, but are not exactly the same, so we can understand the differences, but also to compare and contrast with some states that have not adopted any rule. The ABA adopted it in 2016, but it was after 6 years of debate. There were a number of failed attempts to get the rule passed, but it wasn't until this most recent, until 2016, that it did get officially passed by the ABA. Now, what 8.4, the rule, is about is the general definition of professional misconduct. So it's providing the different bases for attorney discipline. And it's not having to do with anything concerning professional malpractice or anything along other kinds of liability areas, but it is only discussing what can be the basis for bar discipline. And the rule we're paying attention to today, of course, is G. And what it says is that it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, and other protected classes there. And it applies to conduct related to the practice of law. One of the main points I want to get across today, and I'll probably say this a couple different times, is that the 8.4G is clearly an expansion of the rules that were in place previously. It does that in two specific ways. It adds additional protected classes that weren't part of the rule previously, and it also makes the rule apply to other behavior other than just the specific in-court or in-a-law-office behavior. And the line there is pretty clear where it says, in conduct related to the practice of law. Clearly, we don't know necessarily exactly what that means, and we'll spend some time talking about that, but it's clear that the number of protected classes has increased, and so that's an expansion of the rule, and it's also an expansion of the rule because it is talking about conduct that in the past and in some other states' rules were not impacted by the ABA rule. The comment to all the rules provides helpful information to try to let us understand and be able to apply the rules that are contained there. And the comment with regard to 8.4G does provide important information. And one of the things it says is that the kind of discrimination here that is prohibited includes harmful verbal or physical conduct that manifests bias or prejudice toward others. And so the rule here is obviously using words in maybe a little bit different way than we would normally think of them, but it says that they can be conduct. And the rule in the comment also says that the provision includes sexual harassment and derogatory or demeaning verbal or physical conduct. And finally, the comment talks about sexual harassment includes unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, or other unwelcome verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature. The sexual harassment part of the rule very closely mirrors or tracks what you see in Title VII. I think that's a fair analysis here. The other parts of discrimination about bias and both implicit and explicit and cultural competency is an area of law where we don't have the same sort of developed case law and conventional wisdom about its application, and then also that as a result creates some uncertainty. The comment also talks about the notion of what is conduct related to the practice of law. It obviously includes in-office and in-court behavior, and it's also supposed to apply to operating and managing a law firm or a law practice. So bar activities would also be included in the coverage of the new rule, clearly an expansion of what we've had before. And the comment goes on to say that the coverage includes business or social activities in connection with the practice of law. So the ABA provision would have a very wide application and much wider than we had before. And, for example, the cocktail party after the CLE meeting or the cocktail party after the firm annual meeting or a board meeting is within the context of what the ABA rule would actually apply to. Now, I mentioned that the state's treatment of the new ABA rule has not been particularly aggressive or cooperative. As I mentioned, adopted in 2016, and only Vermont so far has adopted the exact ABA version. However, 34 states have adopted some form of the rule to address discrimination and harassment as professional misconduct. I've got a list there of states where that have adopted this rule in which they have Posnelli offices. There are only, well, maybe not only, but there are 16 states that have no such rule. Two of those are in Georgia and Tennessee, Kansas, to the extent we have local folks listening to the presentation today, also is one of the states that has not adopted the specific rule, but it does have a provision in the rules that can apply to this kind of behavior, and we'll address that in a minute. Just in summary, then, how the law changed with regard to the application of Rule 8.4G as adopted by the ABA. It moved the prohibition for this kind of conduct from the comment to the rule, which is an important distinction because the comment is advisory while the rule is obligatory. Previously, it was limited to acts prejudicial to the administration of justice, and this new rule is a drastic and important change from that provision. It changed from in the course of representing the client, which is a fairly narrow application, to applying to conduct related much in a much more broad, a much broader context that apply it to the practice of law generally. And as I noted, the certain protected classes have been added. Those are specifically ethnicity, gender identity, and marital status. Now, let's talk a little bit about the criticisms of the new ABA rule as a result of the fact that not only one state has adopted it in verbatim fashion, but a number of states have some rules similar. Certainly, the adoption of the rule has not been comprehensive. And one of the reasons for that is the criticisms that have been leveled against the rule. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about those. The screen you have in front of you kind of gives a general discussion of what those are, but I want to give some specifics, and I'm going to use a professor by the name of Ronald Rotunda, who is a giant in the field of ethics and in the nerd world in which I operate most of my days, very well recognized, thought of as one of the leading scholars in the area, was the author of the Lawyer's Desk Book on Professional Responsibility, which is one of the leading, or was one of the leading treatises in this area. About within the last year or so, Professor Rotunda is no longer with us, but his criticisms and his analysis with regard to the rule lives on. And at the end of our session today, we're going to talk about a new ABA opinion, which is designed, in my view, primarily to address the criticisms that I'm going to describe now and that were raised by Professor Rotunda. The first one he talked about is that he believes that the new ABA rule is akin to campus speech limitations on race that have been held unconstitutional in many examples. His second argument is that the notion of verbal conduct is an oxymoron, is obviously inconsistent on its face, and believes is not a rational approach or one that provides specific enough guidance. He indicates that the old rule from 1998, which talked about the issues with regard to prejudicial to the administration of justice as a standard, was satisfactory and had been a history of being applied, and he thought provided enough protection. He also made that argument criticizing one of the new protected classes, that of socioeconomic status. And here's an example he gave where he thought that the rule would go wrong and would maybe cover something that it shouldn't, but then at the same time not cover something that maybe it ought to. And here's his example. At a bar association meeting, one lawyer might say something like the following: I abhor the idle rich. We should raise capital gains taxes. Rotunda looks at that and says that is a manifest bias based on socioeconomic status. But then he makes the point that the rule would allow the following response. To argue against that comment, someone might say from the audience, you are saying that just because you are a short, fat, hillbilly neo-Nazi. And the argument he makes is that comment, which some of us might find offensive, would not be a violation of the rule, while the first, which made a reference to capital gains taxes, might therefore be a violation of the rule, and thinks that Professor Rotunda was being critical of the rule for that reason. He also raised the question of religious freedom, and that he focused on LGBT issues. He talked about the fact that there, for example, the Thomas More Society, which is a Catholic organization of lawyers and judges, and he gave the hypothetical of what if they had a COE and expressed views contrary to gay marriage? Would that be a violation of Rule 8.4G? He raised that issue as well. His overall conclusion with regard to the rule was that it was possibly well-intended but was poorly drafted. And that was a criticism that he thought shouldn't be the case with regard to a lawyer-drafted rule. But that he also said that many have argued that judges and bar disciplinary counsel who have to apply this rule in the context of determining whether there should or should not be bar discipline will use their common sense and only apply it in ways that are appropriate and not in an overly sensitive way that might fit into some of the examples that Professor Rotunda gave. His argument about that is that we should not have to rely on judges and bar discipline counsel to fix a rule that is poorly drafted and not designed as well as it should be. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit next about the Missouri rule, which does go beyond just the context or just the notion of something being prejudicial to the administration of justice. And I'm going to use the Missouri rule as fairly typical of the other 34 states that have rules with regard to this issue but have not adopted the ABA rule 8.4G that I've been discussing just before that. So the notion put forth in the Missouri rule is different and narrower than the ABA rule. But what it says is that it is professional misconduct to manifest by words or conduct in representing a client, that's narrower, as we talked about before, but in manifesting bias or prejudice or engaging in harassment, including but not limited to bias, prejudice, or harassment based upon race, sex, gender, gender identity, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, or marital status. So there are some of the protected classes in the ABA rule that were not included, but it also made it a point to emphasize that the rule is not designed and shouldn't be applied to limit client engagement decisions, that lawyers still have full freedom to do that with regard to whatever kind of criteria they might apply. What I wanted to do next, before I go to the next step of the Missouri rule, is to give you some examples of bar discipline that has been imposed in this general area of harassment and discrimination and diversity prior to the ABA provision, and just using rules like the rule we're looking at now that's in the state of Missouri. Here are some examples. There has been bar discipline imposed on a lawyer who accused an opposing party of being an illegal alien, or a lawyer that used anti-Semitic statements and accusations of mental impairment, or doing a racial insult in the course of a trial or a deposition, or another example in the conduct of a deposition, ridiculing a man using a feminine-sounding voice and asking if he was gay. Another example, saying client must answer to God for non-payment of fees, a different collection effort that we haven't considered, but probably not a good idea. Another example, a lawyer sent ex parte messages to a judge disparaging the opposing party on national origin and immigration status grounds. That was the basis for bar discipline. And another example is the defense of anti-Semitic remarks that were expressed in court on the basis that the lawyer had a right to represent his client zealously. Again, that did not pass muster under rules like the Missouri rule. And finally, a lawyer repeatedly harangued opposing counsel at a deposition for mispronouncing words, and the court found that the conduct to be racially motivated. So those are examples of conduct by lawyers that were determined to be misconduct under Rule 8.4 prior to the adoption of 8.4G and without using that, having to have that provision around. A little bit more on the Missouri rule. The rule identifies, gives some rationale for why the rule is adopted in Missouri. And it says there is a special importance of a lawyer's words and conduct. And the rule is not designed to apply to legitimate advocacy. Of course, it doesn't define what legitimate advocacy is, but certainly it's not limited by the rule. And again, as part of the rationale, it says that bias or prejudice by a lawyer impairs the integrity and fairness of the judicial system, but that also conduct, when examined under this rule, should be reviewed under all the circumstances and whether the act is part of a pattern or some isolated event. Of course, the Missouri comment is thereby suggesting that if it is in the context of an isolated event or something that's by itself and not part of a pattern, there is less likelihood of bar discipline. The rule in Missouri does give some examples of the kinds of behavior that the court finds inappropriate, demeaning nicknames, negative stereotyping, threatening or intimidating or hostile acts. All these kinds of things are within the Missouri rule, and I would suggest in many other rules, in the other 34 that have these kinds of rules, and maybe some of the others that only have the standard of something that's prejudicial to the administration of justice. All these could fit into that same old category. And finally, the Missouri rule in the comment with regard to harassment of a sexual nature includes situations when submission is explicitly or implicitly made a term of employment, the response is used as a factor affecting the individual in their employment context, or such conduct interferes with work performance or creates an intimidating or hostile or offensive environment. Those are all examples under the Missouri rule that, and it is obviously an example where the Missouri rule and most other states' rules that have adopted this kind of harassment provision generally track the Title VII process. So now I'm going to pass it over to Ashley to address the first of the two questions, which I know you've all been looking forward to, and get to address that, and then we'll move on with the next part of the program. Ashley?
Great, thank you. This is the first CLE polling question for today's program. You must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. The new ABA Rule 8.4G is intended to broaden the definition of behavior that is defined as a professional misconduct concerning harassment and discrimination. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your browser to submit. Again, the new ABA Rule 8.4G is intended to broaden the definition of behavior that is defined as a professional misconduct concerning harassment and discrimination. Select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you guys are continuing to have any issues hitting submit, please email events@pulsenelli.com. I'm going to give you guys another 30 seconds to answer. Again, select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. Any technical issues, try hitting refresh on your browser or email events@pulsenelli.com. You guys have another 15 seconds. Great. Thank you, guys. Doug, I'll pass it back to you.
Thank you, Ashley. Happy to report that 98, it's amazing, I'm getting a full report as those come in, that 98% of you got that correct. Hooray. I'm moving into the middle third of the presentation where we're going to talk about and kind of dip into the current affairs thing and analyze some issues of explicit bias and implicit bias. But I want to do, before we get started in that middle third, I want to talk about stereotypes and how they play a role in this. And I've got included there the Doug Laird definition of stereotypes in this context. And how I define it is that it's an automatic conclusion about an individual based upon his or her perceived membership in some group that the person, and then concluding that the person has certain characteristics or behaviors just because they are in that group. Now, stereotypes can be positive or negative. See, I would think that there is a stereotype out there in the world, at least I hope that there is, that a Pozzanelli litigator is a very good trial lawyer. That's a stereotype that we want to promote and we work very hard to achieve. But also stereotypes can be negative. And at the end, they can be benign. They can also be very positive, but they can be harmful or even lethal. And so the stereotype in many circumstances is what I would call a heuristic, which is a problem-solving method that uses shortcuts to produce, in some examples, good enough solutions given a limited time frame or when somebody's approaching a deadline. And it is a trade-off, oftentimes, between examining something fully and objectively looking it over for which would be the optimal kind of decision-making process for the trade-off of saving a lot of time. So there are good examples of this. There's some in the stocks and bonds world, there are copycat investors that folks might be buying a bunch of stock just because the hedge funds folks are all buying it, so it must be a really good idea. I won't analyze it myself. I'll just jump in. So a stereotype can be a good thing or a bad thing, but it also can be the basis for implicit bias in a very negative way. Now, the studies, we're going to talk about some studies, but I'm going to give you a little bit of a preview of that, of what some of these studies show with regard to implicit bias and how it can demonstrate itself subconsciously, even though the individual is not meaning to do it or doesn't intend to demonstrate this implicit bias, it can still come out. But here are the elements that the studies tell us that are usually present when implicit bias in a subconscious way can show itself in very specific behavior. There are three elements that when implicit bias is most likely to translate into discriminatory behavior. Number one is that when a person has very wide discretion with regard to what they're going to do or what they're required to do to solve whatever problem is in front of them. Number two is that they're required to make quick decisions. There's a time deadline. You have to decide right away. There'll be lots of different reasons for that, but it's a requirement where you can't step back, think about a situation, and try to analyze it carefully. You have to make a decision right away. And then finally, that the decision maker has little accountability, that there is little risk either way for making a bad decision or making a good decision. And it's in those circumstances where studies show us and our own personal experience show us that the implicit bias can come to the fore and can actually affect the kinds of behavior. Now, one of the things critics might often say about different situations is that a policeman faced with someone that they may perceive, correctly or incorrectly, as a physical threat may fit into those three categories very clearly. They have wide discretion because they have to deal with very different circumstances, and they have to protect the public and protect themselves. They have to make a very quick decision in many circumstances, and some would argue that they have little accountability. Police officers and many other folks in that kind of line of work have qualified immunity. Society's decided and our legal system has decided that's a good thing, but it may lead to this possibility of implicit bias demonstrating itself and coming out in particular circumstances and in a way that it was maybe not all positive. So let's talk about some very specific examples. We're going to move into the current affairs world. Again, I'm not trying to follow any particular agenda, but I am going to use some examples that some would argue are examples of explicit bias and implicit bias. So let's take a look at the first one. This is, by the way, the next three or four screens are at the courtesy of Michael Downey, a colleague of mine who put these together, and I'm using them today is to demonstrate some of these examples. The you may remember the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, back in August of 2017. Let me give you a little bit of background about this. You may recall that Dylan Roof, the fellow in North Carolina who shot and killed nine black people at a prayer meeting, and he had very clear writings that he was trying to start a race war, and he used the he was an avowed white supremacist, and he used the Confederate flag as a symbol to rally around. As a result of that, or as an impact from that, there was a lot of movement to ban or to change the role of the Confederate flag in the South. And then as a reaction to that, there was an idea that we should that it was appropriate to tear down different statues that were then memorialized or that honored, some would argue, different Confederate soldiers or different officials from the Confederacy. And then this rally that we're talking about in Virginia in August of 2017 was a reaction to that. And these folks here, I think it would be fair to say, and most of us would agree, are an example of explicit bias. The folks there were heard to chant a number of different things. Part of them, some of the chants were White Lives Matter. Another example, Hail Trump. Russia is our friend. The South will rise again. And there was an odd one. Harry Potter isn't real. I'm not sure the exact derivation of that, but that was part of what happened that day. And there was other probably more like or more prominent chant was that you will not replace us. And sometimes the chant was Jews will not replace us. There was also a chant of blood and soil, which I'm told is a reference to a German phrase used by the Nazi regime that focused on nativist agenda and was anti-Jew. So this is an example of, I think, fairly, what could be thought of as an explicit bias situation. Now, I'm going to give this, and the next screen has two examples of different events. On the left is something that occurred on April 30th, and it was a protest that took place on the Capitol grounds in Michigan, and it was a protest done by gun-toting folks who were loud on the grounds with military weapons that held protests and speeches about the governor of Michigan's order with regard to lockdown as a result of COVID, the requirement to use masks, and of similar sort of issues. This was a protest that took place. The photograph you have there on the left is took place within inside the Capitol, where the protesters were not allowed to go into a particular room, and note the passive sort of calm response of the police. On the right, however, is an example of the is a photograph taken from a demonstration in Minneapolis on Memorial Day following the death of George Floyd. It's a much different set of circumstances, of course. And I'm not suggesting that the activity of the protesters was identical in these two examples, but certainly the response was somewhat different. Now, what I'm going to do is give an example of President Trump's reaction to these two events. With regard to the one in Michigan, where there were gun-toting protesters on the ground, he says that the governor of Michigan should give a little and put out the fire. These are very good people, but they are angry. They want to see their lives back again. And compare that with his response on June 1st, after the demonstrations in Minneapolis, following the death of George Floyd. You've got to arrest people, President Trump is quoted as saying. You have to track people, you have to put them in jail for 10 years, and you'll never see this stuff again. Here's another example of possibly explicit bias. It is a comparison of the treatment of Meghan Markle and Princess Kate in different newspapers in England, and it's I'll let you read it for yourself, but they're very comparable things going on by Kate, and they are praised or at least thought of in a very described in a very positive way. But Meghan Markle, who has a mixed heritage and is perceived by some as African American or black, is a very negative version of her doing some things that are very, very similar. Probably not as dangerous a comparison, but still gives an example of possibly explicit or implicit bias. And finally, two photographs taken after the Hurricane Katrina. The folks on the left appear to be light-skinned and are bringing supposedly some food and carrying it through the water. And the notion and the cut lines there into that photograph is that after they found after finding some bread, then the person on the right, photograph on the right, a dark-skinned person, the photographer assumed or may have known, but looks like assumed that they were looting because they're carrying food through the waters there that were so difficult for those folks in New Orleans. Now, I want to move next to a study with regard to these issues of black and white. I want to spend some time talking about a study that was done several years ago with regard to lawyers evaluating a piece of writing, and the only difference that they knew about the writing was that some believed it was drafted by a black student and other or a black associate, and others believed it was drafted by a white associate, and how the results or how their evaluations differed. Let me go through what the exact study was. Back in 2014, 60 law firm partners from 22 different firms are given an identical memo. The range of people there is set out there. Each of them got a memo that was drafted by Thomas Mayer, who is a third-year associate from NYU Law School. They all have that exact same thing and all got the exact same materials and same memo. Now, the only difference was that 30 of the partners were told that this very same memo was written by a white associate, and 30 partners were told that the memo was written by a black associate. I want to emphasize that otherwise the materials given to these folks that to do the evaluation was exactly the same. Just like oftentimes happens in these kinds of situations, they got information about the problem itself, some suggested responses, some information about the facts, and so they had some background material to read before they would read the actual memo. Now let's take a look at the results from the evaluations that were turned in by these 60 law firm partner evaluators. The white associate got an overall rating of 4.1 out of a possible of 5. Some of the comments, and these are exemplary, not all of them, of course. Generally a good writer, but needs to work on some specific thing. Has potential, good analytical skills. Overall, the reviews of the White Associates memorandum were generally of a positive nature. The Black Associate got an overall score of 3.2, almost a full point lower. The comments, again, these are exemplary or an example of the kind of quotes that were there. Not exemplary, actually, the writer needs lots of work, can't believe you went to NYU, average at best. Now, think about the implicit bias factors we talked about. These folks probably were in a hurry. They had a lot of discretion, and there's no accountability in this context. So maybe this is an example where implicit bias comes out. Some more information about the evaluation. The White memo that was evaluated, they found 2.9 spelling or grammar errors. The Black Associates memo, 5.8. Remember, it's the exact same memo. Technical writing errors found 4.1 on the White side, the Black had 4.9, and errors of fact found for the White memo, 3.2, and for the Black, 3.9. So in the spelling or grammar errors, they found twice as many. Now, one thing I would like you to consider looking at these results, do you think that this sort of distinction would be enough for a group of evaluators to make a judgment about hiring someone to say yes or no, or if they're choosing between two different folks, or if they're within the firm for possible promotion, or whether or not they might be moved up to give them better assignments or something along those lines. Here's some more information. I suggest to you that it probably would be enough, but I leave that to your own judgment. Also part of the memo evaluation is that there was a similar bias demonstrated by both Black and White and both male-female reviewers, interestingly. The main difference based upon these classifications were that female viewers generally found more errors and wrote longer evaluations. Confirmation bias. And of course, the question I'm posing here is whether that was part of what played a role in this evaluation. Confirmation bias is like a heuristic or a stereotype in the sense that it is a mental shortcut, a bias engaged by the brain that makes one actively seek information, interpretation, and memory to only observe and absorb that which affirms established beliefs while missing or ignoring data that contradicts established beliefs. Now, confirmation bias is something we see all the time, and a trial lawyer, part of their tools is to try to use confirmation bias. And so that's one of the reasons that voir dire, depending on where you're from, and the opening statement are so crucial in a trial from the lawyer standpoint, because you want to get the jurors agreeing with your side right at the beginning. If you can win them over there, you can let confirmation bias do its job the rest of the trial. And so what may happen after that, and my experience is this does frequently happen, is that a juror, once they have a decision leaning one way, after that time, they will actively seek information that supports the bias that they have just created. And they will ignore or miss data that cuts the other way. And so confirmation bias, I believe, is a real thing. It happens a lot. It is something that may be a basis and may be a reason for this implicit bias that comes out in some circumstances. All right, what do we do? What are suggestions to try to address this? Blind evaluations for some projects are a good idea where you don't know the race or gender of the particular individual or may not be able to attach a name to them. So what you may know about them before won't guide you or affect your evaluation. Make evaluators aware of confirmation bias and so they can try to solve that problem and avoid it. Be aware of it and then detour around it so they can solve that problem and not be subject to it. A training on unconscious bias, kind of like we're doing today, for evaluators may be a helpful thing. and offering writing assistance to all groups, not just any specific group that is a group by a protected class, will be a good thing to do. And telling evaluators to take their time to carefully consider, although that's often a difficult thing in our world, we aren't able to do that. I'm going to spend a little bit of time about another study and another one of the tools used in this area to talk about implicit bias. There is a UCLA Law Review article that is well thought of and provides a lot of good information about implicit bias and explicit bias and harassment and diversity and inclusion. And one of the projects they go through is to take a criminal trial and try to identify the different areas where implicit bias on the part of different evaluators can play a key role. This UCLA Law Review is a good synthesis of the academic literature on the area, and in the case you have interest in getting into this a little bit more, it's a good introductory discussion of all these issues. And one of the things they talk about in the UCLA Law Review is that the surveys that they are aware of, and including the ones they took, that 97% of judges believe they were in the top 25% of judges avoiding racial prejudice in decision making. It's a little analogous to the old Lake Wobegon deal that all the children are above average. Of course, it can't be that case. And of course, and some judges and all of us individually may be the product of some self-delusion. But the study suggests that there is evidence that believing ourselves to be objective puts us at particular risk for behaving in ways counter to our self-conception. That is, we need to be aware that we may have a bias, and in doing that, we can avoid having that bias actually influence our real behavior. And so that can be a helpful thing. The different stages of a criminal trial that they identified where this implicit bias may play a role is the reporting of the crime, the charging decision, different decisions made by the judge, different decisions made by the jury were all identified by the UCLA study as errors that are different levels of a criminal trial where implicit bias may play a role. The suggestions from the UCLA study, and I've kind of highlighted them or previewed them a little bit, but here's what they emphasize, and I want to emphasize them for you again, that you should doubt your own objectivity. Try to be as even-handed, as fair as you can, and be aware of the potential for bias. So this kind of increased motivation to be fair can be something that's very helpful and do something very worthwhile in how we evaluate different folks. And that implicit bias is more prevalent when short on time and under a heavy workload is a shortcut that sometimes can fool the evaluator. So what do you do about that? You change the context. If you can, try to use more time and evaluate more carefully, and that way try to avoid being a victim of implicit bias, even when it's subconscious. More diverse evaluators, and sometimes there's little chance of that, and the writing study that we showed indicated that that may not be a silver bullet in this area. So all evaluators, no matter what their gender, no matter what their race, need to be aware of this potential for implicit bias. And then whenever you can, have accountability for evaluators where possible. Now, briefly, I want to go through some of the bias you see in everyday work situations that cause problems for different race and gender groups. That sometimes there's the prove it again notion, where somebody that's in a class that may be a victim of implicit bias has to do more to show their worth as opposed to others. The tightrope problem, where somebody in a protected class may have a narrower range of behaviors that are accepted, while others that are in a different class may get more of a oops and to go outside to accept the behavior and still be okay. The maternal wall, the belief that the commitment and competence of mothers are challenged or criticized, that they're not as career-focused as they should be. The tug-of-war problem, pitting one disadvantaged group against another. and it's important to recognize when these forms of bias arise and address them accordingly. Now, tools for reducing the effect of implicit bias. One of the ways is the blind evaluations, and a good term for that, a shorthand term for that, is orchestra auditions. It is a skills-based assessment without the individual being identified. What orchestras found out is sometimes this implicit bias or a fact of confirmation bias could come into play when they were viewing the performer that they had to evaluate to determine who was going to be part of the orchestra or who's going to be in the first chair viola or first chair trumpet and all that sort of thing. It made a difference that if you could see the person. And so what they've done to fix orchestra auditions and make them more fair is to put a wall between the evaluators and the performer so they can only hear the performance, they can't see the performer. And the idea was that the evaluation would exclusively be based on performance and none of these other confirmation bias sort of shortcuts, which can be useful but also can be misleading. And then the whole idea of commitment to total inclusion is another way to try to do that. I'm going to do quickly through another test that you can consider. It's called the implicit association test. It is designed to test people's implicit bias. It awards you doing a bunch of review in a quick sort of way. The website for that is provided there. Anybody can go take this test. I think that is kind of a blunt instrument and doesn't do a very good job of measuring this, but it is very difficult to measure because you want it for implicit bias to come out. You have to have a very difficult situation or ones that is, you know, time is of the essence, a lot of discretion, and no accountability. So sometimes it's difficult to recreate that sort of situation. It's designed to do that and is thought to try to measure that whole problem. Now we're going to move to Ashley to discuss or to provide our last test question. Ashley?
Yeah, thank you. This is the last CLE polling question for today's program. Again, you must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. Are blind valuations where the evaluator does not know the race or gender of the person being evaluated recommended as a method to avoid implicit bias? Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your browser to submit. Again, are blind valuations where the evaluator does not know the race or gender of the person being evaluated recommended as a method to avoid implicit bias? Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you are continuing to have issues hitting submit, please email events@pulsenelli.com. I'm going to give you guys about 30 seconds to answer. Again, select true or false, and then hit submit in the lower right-hand corner of that slides box. Any issues with hitting submit, please email events@pulsenelli.com. Give you guys about another 15 seconds. And one last time, if any other issues, hitting submit, please email events@pulsenelli.com, and we'll make note for our reporting team. Great, okay, and I'll pass back to Doug.
Thank you, Ashley. I want to spend a moment on this. I accidentally skipped it. Just to spend a moment to talk about the impact between these new legal ethics rules that we've been talking about. We're about to move to the ABA ethics opinion and the connection between that and the Me Too movement. And I want to emphasize this because I think it's important. We have seen, and hopefully we don't see it in the next hearings we have on a new justice to the Supreme Court, where the whole idea of the Me Too movement can play an important or controversial role in the context of those hearings as it did with Justice Kavanaugh. And we all agree that, I think all of us trial lawyers recognize that when a witness comes forward, about a particular event many years later after having not raised it earlier, that that does affect the credibility of that particular witness. And I do know that there are studies that demonstrate that the reason for that delay is logical and completely understandable, but we also recognize that that is not the ideal situation, and it would always be better for the witness or a person that's been subject to this behavior comes forward at the time that it happens. That's better for everyone. Witnesses are more available, recollections are fresher, and all those things. So my point that I want to make here is that if we follow through on the kind of principles that are espoused in Rule 8.4G and in the other similar rules that in the other 34 states, we may encourage folks that are subject to these behaviors to come forward at the time they happen and not to feel ashamed and to feel emboldened to come forward, because we have made it clear that that kind of behavior is not acceptable and is the basis for a claim of professional misconduct in the context for lawyers and hopefully in other circumstances. That's my what I aspire to, and I hope that that's where this is leading. Now, I'm going to talk about, we got about less than five minutes left, and I'm going to go through the ABA formal ethics opinion that was handed down in July of this year. It does give some rationale for the Rule 8.4G. It talks about lawyers as officers of the legal system and that their actions, when part of the practice of law, act in a bad way, erode public confidence in the legal system and trust in the profession. They make the point that the covered conduct need not be part of the representation of the client, and so the application is broader. But it also says that the standard is objective reasonableness, which is not included in the language, but that's the rule that is generally applied to professional misconduct, and that the conduct must be harmful to be grounds for bar discipline. Those are two things that I think are responses to the criticism that Professor Rotunda brought forward with regard to the new rule. They also make the point that lawyers may freely express views on matters of public concern, and that lawyers are not limited in settings unrelated to the practice of law. Again, these are examples that I think are responsive to Professor Rotunda's criticism. Now, I'm going to go through a couple of hypotheticals here that I'll zip through pretty quickly because we're running out of time. A religious organization, these are all part of the ABA opinion, challenges on First Amendment grounds a local ordinance that requires all schools to provide a gender-neutral restroom. Would a lawyer taking on that case violate the rule? The ABA opinion says no, that it does not preclude legitimate advice or advocacy, and it puts this work in that category. The next hypothetical, a lawyer participating as a speaker at a CLE program says that admitting African-American students to highly ranked colleges and universities, he expressed a view about that and says that those students would be better off attending lower-ranked schools where they would be more likely to excel. Does that statement at a CLE violate Rule 8.4G? The ABA opinion says that it does not. It says that a general point of view, even a controversial one, cannot reasonably be understood as harassment or discrimination. A lawyer is a member of a religious legal organization which advocates on religious grounds for the ability of private employers to terminate or refuse to employ individuals based upon their sexual orientation or gender identity. Is that a violation of the rule? The ABA opinion says that it is not. Next hypothetical, a lawyer serving as an adjunct professor supervising a law student in a law school clinic made repeated comments about the student's appearance and also made unwelcome, non-consensual physical contact of a sexual nature with the student. Would this violate the rule? Clearly it would. Obvious violation. And then finally, the last hypothetical, a partner and a senior associate in a law firm have been tasked with organizing an orientation program for newly hired associates. During the session, the partner remarked that rule number one should be never trust a Muslim lawyer. Number two should be never represent a Muslim client. But, of course, we are not allowed to speak the truth around here. Do the partner's comments violate Rule 8.4G? I hope you get this one right. Obviously, it would. So even if one assumes the associate was not Muslim, the comments violate Rule 8.4G. The remarks are discriminatory, as being harmful, and manifest bias and prejudice against Muslims. So in closing, I just want to say that I think there are some difficult issues presented by these new rules. They will play out in the future with regard to how they will be applied. But I think, and I agree with Professor Rotunda, even if I may disagree with some of his criticisms, that these rules are well-intended and are a good idea for the entire legal profession to aspire to and try to comply with. Thank you for your attention today, and I appreciate it. Ashley, back to you.
Great. Thank you. Everyone, this concludes today's webinar. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours directly to all who answered the polling questions. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the BLI website within 24 hours. Thank you all for your participation.